I'm Gina Kaufman, and today I'm going to begin KCUR's Central Standard with a question. How are you feeling about the election results? Let's gather in this space to talk about the 2016 election, how it fits into your life stories here in Kansas City. Is this a turning point for you? Does your own background affect how you see things? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Again, that's 816-235-2888. Now, at some point, we are going to cut to NPR for Hillary Clinton's remarks this morning. Until then, let's talk. While you're dialing, and you are dialing, right? Let's hear from Max Skidmore. He's a political science professor at UMKC, and he's here to talk to you when you call. He can put this moment in some kind of big picture perspective. Hi, Max.
Good morning, Gina.
The demographic lines in this country that we use when we're trying to understand, just in our own minds, who votes how, are they being redrawn right now, or is it maybe time to just erase them altogether? I mean, both fear of Trump and support for Trump seem to cut across every kind of line imaginable, party lines, class lines, geographic lines.
That's true, and there's a precedent for this going all the way back to 1968 when George Wallace ran for president. And he set the groundwork for Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, which became Ronald Reagan's Southern strategy and became actually the strategy for the Republican Party, which has worked in that direction for decades.
Tell me more about that, though. Like, how did George Wallace redraw the lines that Americans used to understand how we're grouped, how we see things?
George Wallace was a Southern governor whose appeal was to Southern segregationists, but he migrated from the South, went into Michigan and other northern states, and received considerable support from white working class people. And that support is echoed, certainly, in the election results for Donald Trump.
We have a guest who we'll be talking to later in this show who might call some of that into question. But, I mean, I wonder if part of the breakdown in a lot of people's predictions about what was going to be happening this morning, if that has to do with a cultural climate where people have stopped even dignifying an opposing viewpoint enough to try and understand it. You know, like, do you think that people communicate about politics differently than they used to?
Yes, I do. We have become far more polarized, and that was a deliberate strategy employed by Newt Gingrich and others who saw an opening where no one else did for Republicans to take over the House of Representatives. In the early 90s, the assumption was that the Republicans had an advantage for the presidency. Either Republicans or Democrats might control the Senate, but the Democrats always would control the House because of gerrymandering and so forth. But Gingrich, a young backbencher from Georgia, had an idea that he could, if you encouraged the trend that Reagan began of opposition to government, government isn't the solution, government is the problem, and so forth, that he could cause a reaction against Congress as an institution, and that would turn out incumbents. And it would hurt some Republicans, but it hurt more Democrats because there were more Democrats than Republicans. And it worked. And in 1994, the Republicans took both houses of Congress. And since that time, most of the time, they have controlled both houses of Congress.
Let's talk to Hector, who's joining us at
816.
Hector, hi.
Hi, Gina. How are you doing?
Good. Hector is joining us at 816-235-2888. And Hector, how are you responding to this morning's results? I mean, do these results fit into your life story in a particular way?
Well, it's. I feel like I woke up in an alternate reality that I that feels very dark and depressing. I was afraid. I never took the results for granted, but I'm still somehow shocked that it went this way.
You are someone who has immigrated to the United States, and I'm wondering, you know, if your attitude toward the country you immigrated to has changed as a result of this election.
It is. It's been very jarring. I came to the United States as a teenager, and I wasn't able to vote for the Bill Clinton presidential race. And one of the, I very much, I guess the main reason, really, the most compelling reason for me to become a citizen was so that I could participate in the democratic process, and so that I would feel like my voice could be heard. And my whole life, since I've been living in the United States, I have felt like I think of myself as a populist, as somebody who believes in giving people a voice. So these election results, kind of being confronted with the fact that nearly half of the population have sided on the side of a political candidate that has been so outspoken against immigration and immigrants and minorities is definitely very jarring and kind of reality shaking.
Hector, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Gina. Have a good day.
You too. Max, is there a precedent for the kind of conversation that we're having right now about a newly elected president's attitude toward race?
I would say not. We certainly have had racist presidents, Andrew Johnson following the Civil War, following Lincoln's assassination. But the country was different at that time. And it was, as I mentioned George Wallace earlier, it was he who made coded epithets respectable, or at least usable in modern discourse. But Trump is the first person who has thrown the euphemisms aside and attacked people directly. He's the only president this country's ever had who hasn't previously served in a public position or in the military at a high level.
We're going to jump in here because I see Kyle Palmer, KCUR's morning newscaster. I was about to say Kansas City's morning newscaster. That's equivalent for me.
Some people consider me the Kansas City's morning newscaster. That's fine with me.
I do myself. Kyle, I know that you're here because there's new information to share.
Yeah, I mean, the one bit of drama overnight for local poll watchers was what was happening in Johnson County. Because they had some tabulation issues. They were not able to finish their count overnight, so they were not able to submit their totals to the Secretary of State's office until about 9 a.m. this morning or slightly before. So we are now getting close enough to be able to call some of these races. Some of these are not surprises, but some of these may come as a little bit of a surprise. First of all, maybe the most closely watched race in Johnson County is the 3rd district congressional seat held by Kevin Yoder. That incumbent does hold that seat over the Democratic challenger, Jay Seide. Fairly comfortable margin right now, sitting at 51% to 41%. Not all of those precincts are counted, but it's close enough to where KCUR feels comfortable enough to call that. So Kevin Yoder retains his seat. The next thing we wanted to highlight was the fact that in Johnson County, four Democrats have picked up House seats in Topeka. Let's highlight those. House District number 16, the Democrat Cindy Holscher, unseated Amanda Grossroad, 56% to 44%. That's with all precincts counted. In House District 18, Democrat Cindy Neighbor was able to beat Republican Eric Jenkins, 52% to 48%. That's with all precincts counted. In House District 21, Jerry Stogsdill, the Democrat, beats Republican Dorothy Hughes, 55% to 45%. That's with all precincts counted. And in House District number 29, Brett Parker, the Democrat, tops the Republican James Todd, 53% to 47%. That's with all precincts counted. So four Democrats pick up seats in Johnson County alone. Statewide, based on KCUR's count, Democrats have picked up 13 House seats in Topeka. They've also picked up a Senate seat in Topeka. So those are the latest results. No concessions yet, no victory calls yet, but KCUR is calling these races.
Wow. Okay. Thank you, Kyle. That was a lot of information, but I'm sure people can, if they're wanting to check back and kind of go through that slowly themselves, when will we have all this information on the website?
So these election results will be updated very shortly on KCUR's webpage. You can both get Kansas and Missouri election results from the federal races all the way down to the ballot questions. Just go to kcur.org.
Kyle Palmer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now let's talk to Michael in Overland Park. He's joined us on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Tell me how this election result is affecting you today.
Well, with great concern. 2 years ago, two summers ago, I came out as a gay man. Up until that point, I grew up in a very rural area of New York State, which was not very open and tolerant. And at the age of 20, I became an evangelical Christian. And so for 31 years, I tried to pray the gay away, went through conversion therapy twice, and nothing happened. And as the experts have said, it doesn't work, and in fact, it causes harm. And now that I finally fully embraced myself, I have hope that, you know, one day I can fall in love with someone that I'm wanting to fall in love with, being able to fall in love with, and other rights that have been granted to me. And I'm very concerned that those are going to be taken away, that we'll be forced back into the closets. And especially with Mike Pence and his stand on conversion therapy, based on his religious views and not on pure scientific fact and what works and what does not work and what has happened in the past and hasn't happened, it worries me a lot.
Michael, is your concern, is it a cultural concern, like that there will be cultural pressure to return to the closet?
Or absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we've already seen that just in the campaign, that the way that Trump bullied people, that has actually had an effect in our schools on an increase in bullying, because they've seen the example of that's how you win, that's how you get to the top. So if this is going to be their culture, they're in the top offices of the nation. There's no way it can't affect the culture around them, especially of the white heterosexual Christian male who seems to be the angriest that dialed into Trump's rhetoric.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call, Michael.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Max, do you see president-elects changing culture that dramatically?
Yes. I wish I could offer some words of comfort, but I think it would be inappropriate for me to sugarcoat something. Some Democrats are taking solace in the fact that, they still have a substantial presence in the United States Senate, although they're a minority, and the filibuster can protect them and so forth. I wouldn't count on that, because I suspect that the filibuster has reached the end of its life. I think the majority Republicans will eliminate the filibuster and eliminate the extraordinary minority capability to obstruct that has characterized the modern United States Senate. It appears as if Hillary Clinton has won the popular vote, at least at this time. And so some people are taking solace in the fact that, Trump won't have a mandate. We always hear the word mandate thrown around after an election, and it is inappropriate for a presidential system such as ours. Mandate really is a term drawn from parliamentary system. A president has power, regardless of mandate. George W. Bush was elected with a minority of the popular vote, and from the start, he functioned as though he was a vigorous, strong, assertive chief executive. He didn't worry about mandates. And my guess is if Trump has the discipline and the ability to concentrate, that he will do whatever he chooses to do. And the caller is right about Mr. Pence. I don't believe that Trump is an anti-gay bigot, whether or not he will permit a vice president to set the tone for the administration remains to be seen.
I want to talk briefly with writer and commentator Sarah Smar. She's a former Kansan who's recently moved to Texas. She wrote an article that appeared in The Guardian on October 13th called "Dangerous Idiots: How the Liberal Media Elite Failed Working Class Americans." And Sarah, how would you summarize the premise of that article?
Hey, Gina. So in that piece, I'm really attempting to dismantle the assumption that working class whites have been Trump's political base. That has been the prevailing media narrative, certainly. And yet numerous sizable polls and studies have really, at very least, complicated and possibly even kind of blown that idea out of the water.
Your own rural working class Kansas background, working in grain elevators and the like, provided you with a lens for interpreting the national media's analysis of the groundswell of support Trump received. And that might help us to understand why so many people were blindsided, not just by his victory, but by specific demographics he seems to have won over, because it wasn't just working class white people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. Yeah. So, well, I think to the first part of your point, my being a kind of rare native of the white working class within media, it gives me a kind of dual citizenship culturally and socioeconomically. So I was able to see that there were some really fishy narratives being bandied about that struck me as extremely classist on the part of middle and upper middle class white media. So to the second part of your point, what we're now seeing in exit polls is that Trump's support transcended income, which is something that a handful of studies did say earlier this year. It was a penchant for authoritarianism that predicts Trump support, not class or their education levels do break along Trump-Clinton lines a little bit, but not nearly so much as people predicted. Overall, what we're seeing, and this is something I was aiming to point out in my essay, is that this is overwhelmingly a white American problem, not a poor white American problem.
Explain that last piece of it.
So the exit polls I've seen, there's at every income bracket level, Trump received about the same level of support. So there's no disproportionate support among the white working class. Of course, there are members of them that that supported Trump. But this kind of hyperfixation by the media on their grievances and parsing the reasons why they were for the Trump ticket sort of allowed quiet, I would say, white suburban vote to that is not going to show up at a Trump rally and scream hateful words, being as they have social capital to lose if they did so. There they were at the polls yesterday, and some of us are not surprised, and I don't relish the fact, but it's a case that a classist media in part was complicit in what just happened to our country.
Locally, some people are seeing a leftward shift for Kansas. And one of the things you pointed out in your article was that more people in Kansas caucused for Bernie Sanders than for Donald Trump, and that was a stat you didn't see a whole lot in national news media. Are there other stats we didn't see that might, affect how people see Kansas and middle America in general?
Yeah, I would make a couple points on that. One is that, as I note in my essay, in 2008, 42% of Kansans voted for Barack Obama, and while that doesn't win the state for in an electoral college system, 42% ain't nothing. And in most supposed red states in this country, so-called, there are legions, millions of people who are voting on the Democratic or blue side of the ticket. So this kind of painting the map in red and blue is really renders invisible a broad swath of America that I think feels disenfranchised by the way that we talk about American politics. As far as just an actual study that's been missed.
I'm going to jump in before you share that study, just to remind our listeners that we will be joining NPR News for Hillary Clinton's address to staff and supporters at some point this hour. We don't know when that's going to happen. So I wanted to remind you just in case it happens soon. But Sarah, please go on with that study.
Yes. So this notion that this is a rural versus urban divide splitting this country, Los Angeles County had, in the primaries, I don't know how it shook out yesterday, had more voters for Donald Trump than the entire state of West Virginia. So, this idea, if we want to talk proportionally, okay, maybe. But I just, Trump yesterday had people turn out, white people largely turn out in droves in cities and suburbs. And meanwhile, I know many rural or small town progressives, myself included. And so, I can't cite the study at the moment. I know an online publication called The Rural Yonder ran a piece about it. There's basically, you know, hey, like Scottsdale, Arizona, it was the money pocket of Trump's campaign. That's you know, affluent folks in a suburb of Phoenix. So I don't know. Get out of here with blaming middle America on Trump's rise. That's how I see it.
What have the last 24 hours been like for you personally? Do these results change anything for you, your goals, your perspective?
I think that I feel, of course, heartbroken politically, but I also think that as a journalist, I want to get out from behind screens more and be engaged more at the ground level. We're in kind of this, I understand the irony of, being someone who has recently had a voice in national media, talking about people who don't themselves have a voice, I'm not sure how else to go about it in terms of spreading this sort of message. But, I feel like a real call to civic action in a way. I've always seen journalism as a civic act and journalism's role as a watchdog for democracy. That's why I went into this field. It's why I have raised my eyebrows at a lot of the election coverage, because I think it put profits and sensational B-roll and conflict-driven narratives above this country. For me personally, I guess I just want to be a citizen first, however I'm applying that professionally.
Sarah Smarsh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina.
And let's talk now with Amanda. Amanda joins us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Tell us your story.
Well, as someone who studied public administrations, in a master's program and works in local government, I'm just in awe that we have elected a president, who has zero political experience, zero experience working in local government or state government or federal government, has never held elected office of any kind, and has never served in the military. I think, to me, even besides all the things that have already been discussed about his outrageous comments that have been overlooked and everything else, that to me is shocking and probably the number one reason why I did not think we'd be in this position the day after the election.
Max, are you as surprised as Amanda is?
I am surprised. I'm stunned. I suspect many of the Trump supporters were equally stunned, not having anticipated the success of Trump's campaign, at least not to that extent. I agree with much of what's been said, most of it, in fact, and I think it's a mistake to underestimate the role of misogyny in this. Hillary Clinton is a strong, vigorous woman, and she has attracted comments and criticisms that are clearly based on opposition to strong, vigorous women.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're getting your reactions to the results of the 2016 election on KCUR's Central Standard. 816-235-2888 to tell us how this moment fits into your story, your political consciousness, when we return. One thing we're not hearing this morning is the sound of the glass ceiling in American politics being shattered. We'll reflect on that deafening silence coming up. We are back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Yesterday's presidential election was a major upset, and it wasn't until the wee hours of the morning that the tide of electoral votes cast for Trump resulted in a decisive victory. In that time, while people were waiting, the tone on social media changed, and talk of the first woman in the Oval Office essentially disappeared. Here's what Missouri's Democratic candidate for attorney general had to say about it in her own concession speech. Teresa Hensley would have been the state's first woman to hold that office had she won.
I think that, if you dedicate your career to public service, and when it comes down to whether people vote an R or a D instead of who's qualified and what they stand for, it's time to to quit bothering with that.
That was Missouri candidate for Attorney General Democrat Teresa Hensley responding not only to her own defeat, but to Hillary Clinton's as well. Cece Rojas, president and CEO of the Central Exchange, is here with us to talk about the glass ceiling that didn't shatter. Hi, Cece. Cece Rojas is with us from the Central Exchange. Hi, Cece.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, here we go. Sorry. It's breaking up the time again. It's all good now.
Yes. Would seeing the first woman elected president have meant something significant to you?
Yes. I mean, I think it would have meant, you know, I think it would have shown progress in a different kind of way. But, you know, I also think that, you know, women are making great strides, not just in Kansas City, but nationally. We did have four women of color elected to the U.S. Senate, you know, which is obviously unprecedented. So there are many other things that can happen that are independent of having had the first female president.
Is the glass ceiling still a major issue for American women outside of politics in your experience?
I think that there are some obstacles that still exist. And I think that, you know, there are, but we do know now there's lots of data that proves why some of those obstacles still exist. I think, though, that we are seeing, once again, there are many women who are excelling and exceeding in their professions, maybe not at the rate with the quickness that we would like to see, but it's definitely starting to occur. I know that we've seen, too, that with a new generation, with the millennial generation, they are you know, graduating at a faster rate. They are taking on leadership roles at a little faster rate. But we also know that they do start to encounter some of the same challenges that other generations did before them when they make the choice to, you know, have a family or get married and take on additional responsibilities outside the workplace.
Does seeing something like Hillary Clinton, you know, in 2008 conceding her party's nomination and then making this rebound and in 2016 winning her party's nomination but then losing the general election, does something like that affect women's decisions about what to try for in life? I mean, do you see that examples out there affect how the women you work with approach their own ambitions?
I guess it would really depend on the circumstance. I believe that, you know, it can be seen as a setback for some, you know, for some women who would have or who would see this type of resilience that in spite of it, if the result was not successful. But I also believe that, you know, some women will see it as an additional challenge, as something that they need to fight harder for. And, you know, women have proven that kind of resilience and that type of perseverance all through time. They may not have received the accolades along the way for it, but I think that that perseverance was there. And I know that I've talked to, you know, several women since that have said, you know, this is just an opportunity for us to create a bigger voice and a more collective voice and collective action.
One last question for you, Cece. Do you think women are vetted differently, whether they work at the pleasure of the American people or at the pleasure of a boss of some kind?
Do I think that they're vetted differently?
Yes.
Yes. You know, I think there's probably more scrutiny because there's other factors that, you know, that you take into consideration with women, whether it's because they have a family or other things that people might perceive as distractions to getting the job done. However, this election cycle, that wasn't necessarily the case. I mean, the media played the scrutiny on the male candidate was as much, if not more so.
Well, Cece Rojas, thank you for joining us from the Central Exchange here in Kansas City. I appreciate your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
Max Skidmore, was your perception the same as Cece's, that the male candidate was scrutinized at least as intensely as the female candidate?
Absolutely not. I think the journalists have failed in this regard, did fail in this regard. The media have not treated... when Donald Trump said the system is rigged, he meant it was rigged against him. Well, clearly it wasn't rigged against him. It may have been rigged, but the media gave Donald Trump an enormous amount of attention, but it was not attention as a political figure. It was attention as an entertainer. And they actually built Trump up and facilitated his candidacy. One thing we've lost, it seems to me, is a sense of civic responsibility. John Kennedy, in his inaugural address, said, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Can you imagine a Donald Trump making that kind of appeal? Instead, what we hear is, "Well, I don't like Trump, and I'm concerned he might even be dangerous, but I just don't like Hillary, and I'm going to vote against her." We've heard this from many people, and this simply is a result of self-gratification. The emphasis is vote your conscience, vote what makes you feel good. Don't consider what's best for the country.
Well, let's talk to Ron. To Ryan. We're going to get his perspective from Gardner. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there. Hey, I just wanted to make a comment about I think it's something that's understated, the factor that social media, particularly Facebook, has had on the election. Specifically, I've spent the last 4 months basically debunking pseudo news that comes across my friends who are good conservatives news feed that are just misinformed. And I think it's a real failure of things like Facebook to not police these pseudo news outlets that are pushing debunked, proven false articles as news. And also the algorithms that continue to allow those same types of news, pseudo news articles to continue on somebody if they've been clicking on it already. So I just want to get Max's thoughts on that.
Okay, thank you, Ryan.
I think that's absolutely correct. The social media have expanded that considerably, but they didn't create it. You find it also in letters to the editor of newspapers and magazines. It seems to me that the editors of these journals should have a responsibility to correct absolute misstatements of fact. If someone writes a letter and says, President Obama has raised our taxes and I reject this, he's a fascist or a socialist or whatever, they print that kind of thing and let it go without correcting. President Obama has not raised people's taxes. There was an interview in Michigan. A worker said he was tired of the last 4 years because gasoline prices have gotten so high and taxes have gone up. Well, neither of those is true.
I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with political science professor emeritus Max Skidmore. Not emeritus, just professor. I wanted to class it up a little, you know what I mean? Anyway, Max, we were just listening to Hillary Clinton's concession speech, as were our listeners, and so much of what she talked about is what we were talking about earlier with the idea of how younger women and even girls are seeing this moment. But I guess I'm wondering from you, where does this fit in the pantheon of concession speeches in your mind?
Well, Hillary Clinton is a unique political figure in American history, actually. No one else has run for president. No other woman's run for president on a major ticket. But no one else has run for president after 30 years of having been vilified by her opponents. They have besmirched her reputation. They've thrown garbage at her. None of it stuck, but it still created an impression that something wasn't right about her. She soldiered on, and she hit exactly the right note, the right tone in this concession speech. And I must say that Mr. Trump last night was very gracious in his comments as well. And let's take them at their word until we find otherwise that we all will work together for the betterment of the country.
Let's talk to Mike in Lee's Summit. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Helen. Thank you for taking my call. I found the tone of both speeches really positive and incredible and inclusive. Why I called in is I've just been kind of surprised both sides of the aisle, not so much from our elected or the folks that have lost the elections, but just by our media, be it conservative media, liberal, call them what you will, but just this continued conversation and dialogue that continues to be very divisive. I mean, suggesting that misogynists have hired or elected Donald Trump over the much more forward-leaning females is, I find that insulting. And, you know, the Fox News and the right side tends to do the same thing, and yet our presidents, be it, and had Clinton won, we'd probably be seeing the same thing. And it's just, it's disappointing, I guess, to some degree.
Yeah.
And to much of it, I also, my wife and I talk, and I kind of scratch my head and say, I don't know that this was this hard to figure out.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I want to get a response because we're almost out of time to that first piece of it. Max Skidmore, do you think that it's our language that is divisive, or do you think that there really is a gulf as large as our language implies between what one part of America believes and the other?
I think the language has helped create the gulf. And I didn't say that misogyny caused this. I said misogyny was definitely a factor. And the truth hurts. If it's insulting, that's unfortunate. But the truth sometimes is.
Well, I want to thank everyone who called in today for this discussion about the 2016 elections. It's been a wild ride. If today turned out how you wanted it to, congratulations. And if you're grieving, hang in there. Max Skidmore, political science professor at UMKC, thank you so much. You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard and keep the conversation going on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we'll be discussing class in America, and we'll be hearing stories from an Israeli artist. That's tomorrow at 10. Tune in. Don't miss it. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Matthew Long Middleton, Andrea Tudhope, and Jen Chen, with help from interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. And don't forget, as Kyle Palmer mentioned when he came in earlier, we're updating kcur.org with all the latest results. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next. Don't miss it.